Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to this interview. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Jeffrey Bale, who is an emeritus professor in the Non-Proliferation and Terrorism Studies program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. Dr. Jeffrey Bale, I'm very pleased to be interviewing you. Welcome to
Thank you.
Lotus Eaters.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you very much. Would you tell us some stuff about your background?
Yes, I'm basically a historian. I received my BA in Middle Eastern Islamic and Central Asian History at the University of Michigan. And then I received my PhD in Modern European History at the University of California at Berkeley. So I was trained as a historian. And originally I studied medieval Islamic and Central Asian history. And then at a certain point, I switched over to modern history because I realized I was spending more time studying the world's most difficult languages than I was actually doing history. You know, I studied Arabic and Persian and some Turkish, and in addition to several European languages, so I could read secondary sources. And then I was at the point where I was going to have to learn Mongolian. And then if I wanted to do the eastern part of the steppe, I would have to learn Chinese and Japanese. So I thought to myself, you know, however fascinating it is to study this, the nomadic tribes in Central Asia, I didn't want to spend like another 10 years just studying difficult languages and not getting around to doing history. And then, of course, ultimately you start thinking, well, if you're really studying things that seem to have so little relevance to the present, that maybe you want to do something, shift to a more modern era of history, so that the things you're studying have more contemporary salience or more contemporary relevance. Of course, it turns out that the study of medieval Islamic history has a tremendous amount of contemporary relevance and salience, given the rise of Islamism and the threat of jihadist terrorism. But anyway, I shifted to modern European history. And then I've always been interested in unusual topics. And so my focus has really been on political and religious extremism of various kinds. And then the other types of subjects that I've been interested in are covert operations, covert actions, intelligence operations, terrorism, you know, all the kind of nasty, sinister topics that a lot of people prefer to avoid. So
the hot topics that we're going to discuss.
That's right. Topics that we're going to discuss and that obviously have tremendous amount of relevance at the present time. So anyway, I think it just goes to show you that no matter how arcane your interests, you'd be surprised to discover just how relevant they might turn out to be, you know,
yes,
depending on societal and political developments at the present time.
Exactly. So let me just say to the audience that my first introduction to your work was the book you have co-authored with Dr. Tamir Baron called Fighting the Last War.
Yes.
Confusion, Partisanship, and Alarmism in the Literature on the Radical Right. And I see you have further publications from Routledge, The Darkest Side of Politics, Postwar Fascism, Covert Operations and Terrorism, Volume 1, and The Darkest Side of Politics, Volume 2, State Terrorism, Weapons of Mass Destruction, Religious Extremism, and Organized Crime.
Yes.
These are books, and I'm sure you have a lot of papers written on these topics.
Articles and monographs, and I'm writing a new book, which is probably going to be my magnum opus, called The Other Face of Rock and Roll Rebellion, which is about the international fascist, quote unquote, music underground from 1978 to the present. So so that's the book that I'm currently working on. And it sort of combines both my scholarly and academic interests on the radical right and also my lifelong countercultural rock and roll rebel lifestyle. So I'm bringing them both together. because of that bizarre background that I have, I'm probably the only person who can really do this subject, properly, because I'm so familiar with those types of music and also, the subject, the various currents of the radical right. So anyway, yeah, so I guess you could say there's somewhat unusual interest, but nevertheless, I think, unfortunately, highly relevant at the present time, given the fact that so many people are generating hysteria about the threats supposedly posed by the right and by the return of fascism and so forth and so on. And that's really the reason why Tamir Baron and I wrote the Fighting the Last War, because we just felt that the literature on the radical right was just increasingly partisan, alarmist, and frankly hysterical. A lot of the literature on the radical right written by academics reads like the kind of blatantly partisan, alarmist literature of watchdog, anti-fascist watchdog groups like Hope Not Hate and the Southern Poverty Law Center and so forth and so on. And in fact, there's been an increasing amount of blending between activists, anti-fascist activists and academics at conferences. And for example, there's academic books that have chapters by anti-fascist activists who are not actually scholars. I mean, some of them know a lot, but they obviously have a blatant partisan bias. I mean, imagine the outrage if somebody was writing a book, somebody put together a book on the radical left, and amongst the people who were authors of that book were members of the radical, were figures on the radical right, or militant anti-communist activists. I mean, people would be outraged and say, well, this isn't a scholarly book. This is more like an activist approach.
Yes.
And that's kind of what we see with a lot of the literature on the radical right now. In fact, unfortunately, you can barely distinguish between the activist literature on the radical right and the academic literature on the radical right now, because they share the same narratives. They display the same hostility and they have the same biases, essentially.
Exactly. So I think that the term far right at the moment is one of the hot topics, and
yes,
also the alarmism, as the alarmism that you're describing with respect to the rise of the radical right. So on a daily basis, both on mainstream media and on social media like Twitter that constitute alternative platforms, we are bombarded with virtually endless people who are using terms like that, who are using
That's
terms
correct.
Like left, radical right, extremism,
exactly.
Terrorism, far right, radical right, extremist right, and the same things for the left. So I think that what we should do, or a good idea for what we do, for what we can do in this interview, is to try and put order into that chaos. And personally,
yeah.
I think that as a historian, you are very well equipped to do this. In a sense, I'm asking the right person to help
me. I hope so, yeah.
To help me put order into
yes.
this linguistic chaos, because it seems to me that unless we combine our historical knowledge with our judgment of people's political and ethical statements,
yes.
we are going to just fall victims of sloganism. Like
That's correct.
Trudeau
yeah.
says, mm-hmm. Trudeau is the leader of the Liberal Party. Suddenly everyone
right.
thinks that liberalism is what Trudeau is putting forward,
yes,
which it is not.
And speaking as a classical liberal myself, I would Trudeau is the last person I would refer to as a liberal.
Yes.
You know, there we're talking about somebody who's an illiberal yeah. progressive, quote unquote. And whenever I use the term progressive, I always put it in quotation marks, because in my opinion, there's really nothing progressive about progressivism.
Exactly.
But that's a whole other subject. But yeah, getting
yeah.
back to your point about the far right and the terms, and people toss around these terms, far right, extreme right, radical right, without really being very specific. And even frankly, even amongst academic experts, there's no consensus on what the terms far right and extreme right and radical right mean. And so that's one of the biggest problems. I mean, if the experts can't even agree on how to precisely define and delimit these terms, then it's not surprising that activist types and other people who are less informed are going to be are going to be misusing and abusing those terms. And that's precisely what we see, as with the term fascism and so forth and so on. So maybe the best way to begin is to try to talk about the four main the way in terms of our categorization scheme, the four main elements of the right. And of course, I mean, we can talk about the ideas associated with the left and the right at the time when those terms were first introduced in the late 18th century. If you want to get into that, the weeds of that. Or we can talk, you know, clearly, if you're, let's just say in the most general sense that that the ideas associated with the left are emerged from the European intellectual movement known as the Enlightenment. And then that movement, you know, promoted certain core ideas. So originally the term left referred to people who supported Enlightenment ideas and supported at least certain phases of the French Revolution. And as I said, who sat on the left side of the French assembly, the States General, and then the National Assembly. And then the term right was applied to defenders of the Ancien Régime, people who were opposed to various Enlightenment ideas and who were opposed to the French Revolution. So that's really where the terms left and right first used in a political sense. Of course, since then, the left and the right have evolved or devolved depending on your perspective. They've changed over time. Ideas associated with the left and the right have changed over time. The problem, of course, is that some of the way that the left evolved evolved in a direction that I think the Enlightenment intellectuals would have found appalling. So, for example, when you actually identify the ideas associated with the Enlightenment, they can be used to support, on the one hand, the most radical forms of individualism, because one of the core ideas of the Enlightenment, along with rationalism, the idea that humans are basically good, optimism regarding human progress, was egalitarianism. Of course, the term egalitarianism can mean many different things. It can mean equality before the law, it can mean equality before God, it can mean equality of opportunity, it can mean equality of results, and so forth and so on. But in the Enlightenment sense, the term referred to the idea, which was really probably the most radical idea in the history of political thought, that all individuals have certain intrinsic natural rights that cannot be abridged. So this is the kind of idea which is the basis for modern ideas of individual rights and individual freedom. And again, it's the most radical idea in the history of political thought, because all traditional societies didn't have a concept that the individual had rights separate from the community. And whatever rights the individual was thought to have, they were never articulated, were always considered to be subordinated to the interests of the community. So the idea that individuals have certain rights that can't be abridged is really the most radical idea in the history of political thought. And it really kind of undermines and subverts traditional societies for that very reason. But anyway, so on the one hand, you can have that kind of idea that emerges from Enlightenment thinking. And then on the other hand, you can have people misinterpreting the ideas of Rousseau about the general will and so forth and so on, where you end up with the most extreme forms of collectivism in the form of communism or collectivist anarchism. So in other words, ideas that are associated with both the left and the right, you develop in different ways over time, and they oftentimes develop in ways that are completely incompatible with each other. So you can really see, for example, that the idea of the emphasis on individual freedom on the one hand, and the emphasis on collectivism on the other, of the communist type, are completely antithetical to one another. Yes. And yet both can be said to derive from some of the core Enlightenment ideas, you know. And so that's one of the issues. The first point I want to make here is that the political spectrum, the left-right political spectrum, is kind of an overly simplistic spectrum, because it suggests that people who have left-wing ideas, quote-unquote, are on the far pole of a spectrum from people who have right-wing ideas. that there's no areas where they can join or intermingle and so forth and so on. And I think that's really not only an overly linear way to look at it, but a very simplistic way to look at it. I think the more accurate political depictions of the political spectrum, if you will, are like in more in the form of a circle, whereas on the top of a circle you have like the most totalitarian versions of the left and the right. You like on the left side you'd have communism be right adjacent to fascism, the most totalitarian version on the right side, and on the bottom of that circle you'd have the most the ideas on the left and the right that were the most that emphasized individual freedom the most. So you would have like classical liberalism and individualist anarchism on the left side, and then on the right side you'd have libertarianism. You know, so there you can see this. So there the left and right are right next to each other. You know, the totalitarian left and the totalitarian right are adjacent to each other. They have much more in common with each other than they have with other elements of the left and the right. And similarly, the anti-authoritarian elements of the left and right are close to each other, and they have much more in common with each other than the more authoritarian and collectivist elements of the respective views.
So let me just summarize and tell me if I'm summarizing incorrectly your point. You would say mm-hmm. that the initial distinction between left and right originates from the French Parliament after the French Revolution, where the left described those who sat on the left side of the parliament and the right, those who sat on the right side. And the left was generally speaking pro-French Revolution, especially in its most radical forms. And the right was a supporter of the old establishment. Now,
it really began a little bit earlier than that. I mean, because there were people who sat on the left side of the spectrum who supported the left side of the assembly, who supported the early phases of the French Revolution, but then they were shocked and horrified by the later phases of the French, the Jacobin Terror and so forth and so on. So it really began earlier than the French Revolution and then continued throughout the revolution, the seating arrangements.
Exactly. So I have a question here about the Enlightenment, because it seems to me that a lot of the times people are talking about the Enlightenment as if it was one movement, whereas it's an umbrella term of plenty of movements. So, for instance, the Scottish Enlightenment, having Hume, Adam Smith, and Douglas Stewart, Adam Ferguson, they don't seem to me to resemble ideas of the left in any sense.
If you think of the main ideas of the Enlightenment as being one that promotes like not only the use of human reason, the application of human reason to solve human problems, but also the importance of free debate and so forth and so on, and the free exchange of ideas. You know, that's very important when we're talking about, remember like in 18th century France, a lot of the Enlightenment intellectuals met in these salons. You know, they met to discuss issues, and they met with people with very different ideas, and they were having lively philosophical and political discussions with other people and so forth. So part of the whole Enlightenment project is really trying to break with the rigid orthodoxy, rigid intellectual and religious orthodoxy that was still dominant in the 18th century. And so within that idea, if you're a person who supports reason discussion, and if you're a person who supports the idea that individuals have certain intrinsic rights, and you're a person who supports the free discourse and free association of ideas and so forth and so on, obviously that means that people can come to different conclusions about political values, social values, and so forth. So even amongst the French Enlightenment people, I mean, there were very, very great differences between Rousseau and other leading Enlightenment thinkers. And of course, as the Enlightenment spread elsewhere to Britain and Scotland and to continental Europe and especially to America, I mean, the American founding fathers were mostly Enlightenment intellectuals. Many of them had lived in France and so forth and so on. And so even with the French and American revolutions, you can see a very significant difference. I mean, the French Revolution had a much more collectivist orientation. The Declaration of the Rights of Man in 1789 was much more collectivist in its orientation than the Declaration of Independence, which had a much more individual individualized focus. So the point is, you can have, even amongst the same intellectual movement, you can have very wide range of opinions. And the same thing would be true of the movements that arose in opposition to the Enlightenment, which would be like, for example, the Romantic movement in 19th century Europe, which basically emphasized the feelings and emotions in irrationalism, more than as opposed to overemphasizing reason, because one of the ideas that the people who were on the right adopted to oppose the Enlightenment emphasis on rationalism was what I call philosophical anti-rationalism. It doesn't mean irrationalism, but it means the recognition that human beings are not rational calculators. Human beings are basically animals with a kind of a thin veneer of rationality, and they're driven by emotions and sentiments and unconscious drivers that they're not aware of. And so to thinking that human beings are simply rational calculating machines that somehow can resolve every problem, and ignoring the underlying behavioral drivers that human beings have, which are based on non-rational elements, is a mistake, you know. So the Romantic movement basically overemphasized, you could say, like the sentiments and the emotions and things, which provided great art and literature and things like that. But politically, it led to all kinds of, it had very negative consequences. Emphasizing the value of irrationality in politics is not usually a good thing.
Okay, so we have, let's say, said that the distinction between left and right originates from before the French Revolution, and it had to do with where people were sat in the French Parliament and the kind of right. policies they were putting forward. So
that's right.
How do we go from that to the far right? That is the notion that everyone has been talking about. What okay, is it well, supposed let, to be?
Yes. Okay, well, let me just say one last thing about the counter-Enlightenment ideas, which were developed in response to Enlightenment ideas. And those include the idea, like I said, the philosophical anti-rationalism, the understanding that human beings are not fully rational, the idea that human nature is basically evil, you know, somewhat derives from the notion of the Christian notion of original sin. And that means you have pessimism about human progress. If you don't think that people can be completely rational, and you think that human beings are basically evil, then it's hard to have a faith in human progress, inevitable human progress. And then in response to the idea of egalitarianism, that's to say the idea that individuals have certain intrinsic rights, of course the right counterposed the idea of elitism, the certain natural hierarchies needed to rule human societies and so forth and so on. And then I didn't mention what another key aspect of the Enlightenment left, which was cosmopolitanism. You know, the idea that despite all their differences, human beings everywhere are the same, and so all human beings are part of the same family. And that's sort of an idea that's associated with the Enlightenment. So human beings have more in common, despite all their observable differences, than they have differences. In contrast to that, the right promoted particularism, you know, the idea that human beings owe their primary loyalty to their own communities, not to man, abstract, universal man, you know, and so forth and so on. So those are things that are kind of important to understand. All right, so let's get to the terminology now. So as I said, when you're talking about the terms like the far right that are so casually tossed around nowadays, really the term far right now has become sort of like the term fascism, which is basically, it's almost like an epithet. It's become like an epithet, a term of abuse that's really devoid of content. Basically people call other people fascists who they really don't like. That person has political views I really don't like. He's like a fascist, you know. That person has political views I really don't like. I'm going to call him a far right person. So nowadays, the term far right is always used, for example, in the media almost to refer to almost everything to the right of progressivism, you know,
yes.
including moderate liberalism, you know, and certainly it's used for everything to the right of the center right, of the establishment center right. But that's just all that does is jumble together a vast array of different intellectual currents that exist on the right side of the political spectrum. So using that term in such an imprecise way, all it does is conflate and confuse reality. So we have to distinguish between four different types of the right. This is the categorization scheme that we've outlined in our book. The first is the conservative right. The conservative right is basically the establishment right, you know, basically a right that supports the system and supports various things that people tend to associate with conservatism, private property, strong military, a limited
law
government.
And order.
On the one hand, limited government, but on the other hand, law and order. so it's a little bit confusing there. And market economies and so forth and so on. Okay, the next category of the right is what I would call the dissident right. The dissident right. The dissident right is all the currents of the right who are opposed to the establishment right, but which do not actually, but are willing to work within the system. So it tends to be all kinds of currents on the right that are highly critical of the establishment right, ranging from paleoconservatism to radical libertarianism, and a whole slew of other things that we could enumerate and discuss. But the point is that when we're talking about the dissident right, we're probably talking about people who are highly critical of the establishment right, but who are perfectly happy to work within the democratic system. They're not advocating the subversion of the overthrow of the democratic system, the dissident right. Then the next group would be the radical right, and now we're moving into the milieus where they are actually advocating the subversion and overthrow of the system. These are people who are fundamentally opposed to the existing status quo in various ways, and who therefore feel like the current system needs to be changed, possibly even overthrown. And here we're really talking about, radical nationalists, Catholic ultra-traditionalists, certain kinds of religious fundamentalists, in Europe, royalist extremists, people who do not like bourgeois democracy, and or people who are opposed to the baleful influence of big capital, various other things. And people who are willing, therefore, to challenge the validity of the democratic system, and generally that means proposing, to establish a more authoritarian political system that they can use to promote their agendas and mobilize people in support of social solidarity and whatever. But the radical right is, despite its anti-regime and anti-establishment thrust, is reactionary. It's reactionary in the sense that it wants to try to restore something that a presumed past golden age. It wants to restore aspects of a presumed past golden age. And so that it's backward looking in certain respects, even though it's willing to adopt modern methods of propaganda and agitation and subversion and possibly resort to violence. So that was what we meant by the radical right. So now we're talking about the anti-establishment right, the right that's not willing to work within the system. And then the last category is the revolutionary right. And the revolutionary right is like the radical right in the sense that it rejects the current system and wants to transform it. But the revolutionary right is even more, as the name implies, the revolutionary right wants to fundamentally transform the system. So it wants to mobilize the masses in an attempt to overthrow the system and really change the entire social and political structure, create a new revolutionary regime. So that's what we're talking about with the revolutionary. And what kind of movements would fall into the category of the revolutionary right? Fascism. Fascism would be a revolutionary right movement. And so would Islamism. So would Islamism. We'll talk later about Islamism. But
go ahead. Finish mm-hmm. your sentence.
Go ahead. No.
So I have some questions, particularly about the distinction between the dissident right and the radical right that you mm-hmm. mentioned. So
Yes.
You are saying essentially that there are four categories in the right, as you and Dr. Tamir Baron are writing in your book, Fighting the Last War. So we have establishment conservatives, then we have dissident right, radical right, and then revolutionary right. So when it comes to the dissident right, would you said that they are highly critical of the establishment right, which would suggest that they do call for a change.
They do, but their problem with the establishment right is that it if you think about the conservative right, I mean, supposedly the definition of conservative implies something about conserving something. The idea is that you want to conserve. Well, let me just explain what I think conservatism is, and maybe that'll help clarify what we're talking about. I mean, I would actually say that conservatism is more of like a kind of disposition, almost like a psychological disposition, than an actual doctrine per se. I mean, basically, a conservative is somebody, not somebody who's opposed to all change, but somebody who believes that whatever change, social and political changes occur should be gradual rather than sudden. And that's one thing. The second idea that one could associate with conservatism is that they believe that the positive elements of the past should be preserved in this process of change. In other words, not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Let's not reject everything. Let's not overturn everything. We want, as society is changing, we want to preserve the positive elements in this process of gradual change. So you could call, for example, the Soviet Politburo under Brezhnev conservative, because they weren't promoting revolutionary change. They were part of the nomenclature. They were part of the system that was in a privileged position, and they wanted to preserve their position within this system, and so forth and so on. So that's what I mean when I talk about conservatism in general. The conservative right is what we've already talked about. Now, one of the main things that the dissident right believes, all the different currents of the dissident right believes, is that the establishment conservative right has failed to conserve anything of value, that it keeps, it is incapable of resisting the push by the left to transform things, to make progress, to move toward progress, and therefore they feel that the conservative right has been corrupted and co-opted by its privileged position within the establishment, to the point that it no longer is willing to really take a stand and oppose what they consider to be dangerous trends pushed by the left. So the dissident right, all the different guys, you're talking about race realists, you're talking about immigration patriots, you're talking about like I said, radical libertarians, paleoconservatives, neo-reactionaries. There's a whole group of dissident right ideologies that one can enumerate, but the main thing that they all share, they don't agree with each other. All those different components of the dissident right disagree with each other profoundly. But the one thing that they agree with is that the conservative right is part of the establishment, has been corrupted and co-opted, and is not conserving anything of value anymore.
Okay, so when it comes to the radical right that you think is distinct from the far right, which you identify,
I don't use it as the far right at all. In fact, I would say that what I call the radical right is the same thing as the. You could use the far right and the extreme right as a synonym for the radical right.
Okay.
I don't think there's any people who tried to distinguish between the far right and the radical right and the extreme right. To me, those distinctions don't seem to me to be spurious. So from my point of view, I prefer the term radical right, but I think it basically means the same thing as the far right and the extreme right.
Okay, so I think in your book you draw a distinction between extremism of ends and extremism of means. Would you say that this distinction is pertinent to the distinction between the radical right on the one hand and the revolutionary right? In that the radical is a bit more theoretical, whereas the others try to put it to action.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that in both cases we're talking about an extremism of goals. And in both cases, we could be talking about an extremism of means, in the sense that both might very well cross the threshold of violence and carry out violent actions against the system or against their enemies, their perceived enemies in society. So I think that both the radical right and the revolutionary right would be would certainly have extremist goals and also be willing to use extremist means. So the real difference is that the radical right is trying to restore something that they think existed in the past that has been lost. So they want to restore national greatness, for example. They want to restore religio-centric society, or they want to bring the kings back. They want to bring the royalty back, or something like that, right?
So, okay, I have two questions here. So when you talk about people wanting to restore national greatness, it seems to me that this is something that virtually everyone says so. So that would have to require a particular conception of what it means for the nation to come back.
Of course.
Because a lot of people would... Excuse me?
Yes.
Just wanting to make the nation, let's say, improve, doesn't seem to me to be particularly radical in itself.
No,
some forms of it...
I would agree with you.
Okay, yeah.
I would agree with you that it doesn't necessarily have to refer to some kind of authoritarian or illiberal nationalism. But when we're talking about the radical right, it does.
Yes.
And I
yes,
think that's the point. When we're talking about the radical right, the kind of nationalism they envision is an illiberal nationalism, and it's an authoritarian kind of nationalism. Whereas other people might be talking about restoring national greatness, but not necessarily having those illiberal and authoritarian dimensions to it, something along that line, I would say.
Right. So let's go to the other term of abuse, fascism.
Okay.
To my mind, when we're talking about terms, there is a distinction between the conventional meaning that mm-hmm. a term has and the technical yes. or personal meaning that something means when they use a word. So, for instance, a lot of texts start with authors defining their terms. I'm reminded, for instance, of Thomas Reed, who in the essay of The Active Powers of Man starts by saying, by the liberty of the will, I understand the power that man has over the determinations of his will. So in that sense, he's introducing a term and he says precisely how he conceives of it. We could say that this is the personal meaning. And then we also have the conventional meaning, which is the meaning most people associate with a word. And that refers to the common aspect of language, because as social creatures, and we need to use language that is a public institution, if Wittgenstein is correct, that yeah. has a sort of, let's say, social aspect into it. And there's the meaning most people associate with a term. Now, to my mind, the term far right has connotations to fascism. But
I think that's deliberate. In other words, I think that a lot of people who use the term far right as an abuse are trying to associate it with fascism, actually.
Okay.
They're trying to suggest that anybody that they label far right is akin to fascism or a proto-fascist. And that's part of the whole attempt to delegitimize and demonize all elements of the right that the left and the establishment don't like.
But that comes when people don't define what they mean by the far right.
Because that's correct.
They could just use it as a smear. Because,
that's exactly
for instance,
right. mm-hmm.
you gave your classification, and whether people agree with it or not, they can say that, for instance, they can use that classification and judge future statements you may make about whether particular people or movements belong to the radical right or not. But a lot of people, politicians, journalists, activists, mm-hmm. they are making statements on a daily basis about the far right, and they do not define it. So would you say that they do it in order to create maximalist smearing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I think that's precisely the point of it. If you,
yeah.
the vaguer the use of the term, the vaguer, the more expansive the application of the term can be. And I think essentially the term far right essentially refers to any belief system or any movement that the current regnant establishment, which I would call the progressive globalist establishment, and people on the left don't like.
Okay. Question now, how big of a threat is it? If we believe mainstream media, it is the major threat in the Western world. And yes. We could say that very frequently they react to a lot of killings of people by scaremongering about the far right. So for instance, last Friday, we had stabbings in Solingen in Germany at a diversity festival from someone who seems to be an Islamist. And the establishment response to that event was to just scaremonger about the far right.
That's
so
correct.
It seems that at every chance they get, the establishment, as people who represent the establishment in the Western world, they're trying to constantly pay their taxes, let's say, intellectually speaking. They constantly think they have to talk about the dangers of the far right. So right, they create, if people take their words at face value, they would think that the far right or the radical right, let's say, is the greatest threat right now in the Western world. What do you make of this, and how do we assess threats?
All right, well, there's a whole bunch of things that we need to unpack here. First of all, let's talk about the biased coverage of the events, like, for example, the attack in Solingen. There's two issues that are involved here. And after every jihadist terrorist attack, the main concern of the media seems to be, oh my God, what about the far right response to this attack? They're more concerned about the far right response to a jihadist attack than they are about the jihadist attack itself and the threat of Islamism. And let me just point out, and this is something that we make very clear in our book, Islamism is the most dangerous revolutionary right movement in the world. Let me say that again. Islamism is the most dangerous revolutionary right ideology and movement in the world. And it's committed tens of thousands, over probably 200,000 people have been killed just since the 1990s by jihadists in various parts of the world, mostly in the Muslim world, right? 44,000 terrorist attacks or something, people are calculating. I don't know if they're using the correct definition of terrorism, but the point is that the Islamists have carried out an enormous number of mass casualty attacks all over the world and have killed tens and tens of thousands of people. You would think that any sane person would be thinking, well, if I'm concerned about the right, my main concern is going to be about Islamism. But no. After every jihadist or terrorist attack in Europe or in the U.S., what is the media talking about? Oh, the Islamophobic backlash. You know, or something like the imagined Islamophobic backlash. So the first point is that they're not even identifying Islamism as a revolutionary rightist ideology, which is just mind-boggling to me. So in other words, but it actually makes sense from their point of view, because they're always trying to portray Muslims as victims. You know, Muslims are always innocent victims, and jihadists who carry out violence have nothing to do with Islam, blah blah blah. All this is nonsense, and we can get to Islamism a little bit later. But the point I'm trying to make is this kind of coverage is completely dishonest because, number one, it's not focusing on the perpetrators of the attack, who are Islamists, who are radical revolutionary rightists of the most dangerous kind, who are living amongst us in Western societies and are being incited by Islamist groups and jihadist groups all over the world to carry out attacks on infidels, right? That's an omnipresent and ever-present danger in every Western country. That's where the security focus should be, not on the Islamophobia backlash and the supposed threat from the domestic right. I mean, that's basically a canard. I don't mean that the domestic radical right and the revolutionary right don't constitute a threat, but that threat is consistently exaggerated, whereas the threat posed by Islamism and jihadist terrorism is consistently minimized or ignored. That's the reality. All right,
does this happen? Okay, sorry.
Let's do these things in order. First of all, let's get back to fascism, because one of the main narrative tropes that one finds in the media, you know, there's all this drum beating about the fascism is on the march, the fascism is returning, blah blah blah, and of course people who they don't like, politicians that they don't like, and boomers they don't like, are falsely smeared as fascists all the time by the mainstream media, by establishment politicians, and of course by the radical left. And once again, we're dealing with the term, which is essentially an epithet. You know, and it's something you really hate, you call it a fascist. Well, the problem is that 99% of the time when people call somebody else a fascist, it's inaccurate. And the reason is because most people don't even know what fascism is. This is the fundamental problem. I mean, most people, when they think of fascism, they just think of, oh, this horrible, they think of Nazism. Basically, most people think of fascism, they think of Nazism. Oh, this totalitarian regime, the mass murdering regime. And yeah, that, I mean, Nazism was one of many fascist regimes that did commit these horrible atrocities. But the point is that this is the image that people have in their mind, you know, that the goose stepping Nazis are going to be marching on the streets and like overthrowing democracy and all. I mean, it's just completely absurd. So let me just say a little bit of something about what fascism is, and then I'll talk about the real threat posed by the fascism and so forth and so on, and the radical right. Okay, so again, fascism is another term that even experts don't agree on how to define. And there's a very large number of definitions of fascism that have been generated by people who are specialists. And I would say the three main type that the three main ones we want to talk about, one would be like Roger Griffin's definition. Roger Griffin has tried to create, who's a good friend and colleague of mine, has tried to create like a consensus definition of fascism. It hasn't succeeded, but his idea is that fascism is a kind of palingenetic form of ultra-nationalism. Palingenetic, means obsessed with national rebirth. So it's an anti-liberal form of nationalism that's obsessed with national rebirth. And that is true. That is one component of fascism. So illiberal nationalism is one component of fascism. But in Griffin's definition, he doesn't include the other component, which I'm going to get to momentarily. The more common definitions of fascism are kind of laundry list definitions of various characteristics of fascism. The problem with those laundry list definitions is that they commingle ideological beliefs of fascism with the characteristics of fascist regimes. And so they get all muddled and confused. Let's just be straightforward. If you really want to understand an ideology, you have to focus on the core beliefs, and you have to focus on it in the movement phase before any of these movements succeed in taking power. Because once a revolutionary movement takes power, then it becomes compromised, and it has to institutionalize itself and so forth and so on. So to really understand the core of an ideology, you have to go back to the very earliest movement phase these kinds of movements. So, just with respect to fascist regimes, we can say that fascist regimes are very similar to communist regimes. They're totalitarian regimes that aim to control every aspect of life and transform the consciousness of everybody, and as determined by a party state. You know, so if you look at the literature on totalitarianism in the 1950s, people will recognize these fundamental similarities between fascist and communist regimes, and that's absolutely true. So we don't have to talk about the regime. Let's just stick to the ideology. So the ideology is, one part of it is this illiberal nationalism that, like Griffin emphasized, and the other part, which Zeb Sternhell, who's I think the most insightful scholar on fascism, is that illiberal nationalism is combined with a non-Marxist form of socialism. And by the way, Sternhell's conception is in fact supported by many fascist intellectuals. I mean, I've read a lot of literature produced by fascist and neo-fascist intellectuals, and these people are extremely anti-capitalist. You know, the idea that fascism is pro-capitalist, this ridiculous idea that the Marxists are always peddling, is just complete nonsense. The fact is that visceral anti-capitalism is a key aspect of fascism. Now, the kind of socialism that the fascists are promoting obviously is not the same thing as Marxism. because we're not talking about the class warfare and the expropriation of private property or anything like that. What we're talking about is creating like an organic national community in which no groups are allowed to exploit other groups. So you can't have capitalists exploiting workers in a fascist state, because that would disrupt the social solidarity and the unity of this organic community. And therefore, if capitalist enterprises behave in a way that the fascists regard as anti-national, then they're going to be politically disciplined. At the worst case scenario, they'll take all the bosses of these firms out and line them up against the wall and shoot them. So the difference is that fascism is not promoting like a classless society, but rather an organic community where all the different components of society work together harmoniously, like the organs of a human body. So it's not some kind of leveling classless society. And for that reason, they're perfectly willing to leave the means of production in private hands, as long as it's politically subordinated to the interests of the nation, which means as determined by the party, right? So that's the difference. But so there is this kind of non-Marxist kind of socialist idea, the idea that capitalists, the big capitalists, what the fascists call plutocratic capitalists, cannot be allowed to exploit people or damage the interests of the nation. Okay. So one last
point. As defined by the party.
Yes, as defined by the ideologues or by the party if they take power. So when you think about every fascist movement, every genuinely fascist movement, and by the way, this constellation of elements from the left and the right first came together in France in the early 20th century. But when you think about every fascist movement, every fascist movement has a left wing and a right wing. And that's because they appeal to different kinds of people. Certain elements within the fascist who join fascist movements are primarily find the nationalist elements of fascist ideology the most appealing, and other people who join fascist movements find the social revolutionary and anti-capitalist elements the most that's what they approve of the most. So in every group, including Nazism, there's a left wing and a right wing within the fascist movements, and those factions are struggling for dominance. As it happens because of the conditions of interwar Europe, the political conditions, the right wing elements within those fascist movements tended to come to the fore and ultimately outmaneuver the left wing elements, and oftentimes purge them and massacre them, as in the case with the SA was massacred by the SS and so on. And the Strasser brothers were exiled and by Hitler. So that's the thing you have to understand, that the fascism is the goal of fascism is to bring together different currents of the left and right wing thought and to forge a new revolutionary synthesis capable of mobilizing a revolution against both bourgeois parliamentary democracy and also opposed to communism, which is internationalist. Because obviously, given the emphasis of fascists on nationalism, that's antithetical to communist notions of destroying nation states and creating an international classless society, right? So fascism and communism are rival revolutionary movements. It's not that one's counter-revolutionary and one's revolutionary, they're both revolutionary movements, but they're antithetical in terms of their goals. Okay, now getting back to the question. So now we wanna talk about whether fascism and radical right constitute a serious threat in the post-war period. And here we have to distinguish between a political threat and a security threat. From this point of view, a political threat, no. The fascist and radical right movements are tiny fringe groups on the margins of every Western society that have no institutional base of support, they have no resources, and they have no mass base of popular support. So they're tiny fringe marginalized groups. There is no chance that fascist grouplets are ever going to seize power or come to power in Western democratic societies. So anybody who claims, and that's been true ever since the end of World War II. So anybody who claims that fascism is on the march, that fascists are fascism has returned, the fascists are going to destroy democracy, those people are either living in a fantasy world or they're lying. They're lying for political advantage.
I have a question here. Sorry, finish your sentence.
Yeah, there's two exceptions, I mean, to what I'm saying as far as political threat. In the early post-war era, there were some political parties that were established by former fascists and former Nazis. So for example, in Germany, you had the NPD. Well, the first one established was the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, established in Italy in the late, in the mid 40s. And then you had the NPD, the Nationaldemokratische Partei Deutschland, established in the early 1960s. And there were some smaller parties that fascists or that ex-Nazis had tried to create before that. Those parties never, I mean, the MSI was the one that had the most influence, but even it didn't have much influence in the electoral sphere. They elected local people, but it didn't have a strong president, never was able to form a government, was never part of a coalition government or anything like that. So there were a couple of political parties created by fascists that were participating in elections, but they didn't have much popular support. The much more dangerous group, the much more dangerous exception, is that during the Cold War, and this especially in Italy, but also in the Iberian Peninsula and in Belgium and in parts of Latin America, radical right paramilitary groups, including neo-fascist groups, were infiltrated and manipulated by factions of the Secret Service, by the Secret Services in various them. And this is particularly noticeable in Italy, where there was a systematic campaign of right-wing terrorism between the late 60s and 1980 called the Strategy of Tension. And the groups that carried out this, most of the groups that carried out this terrorist strategy, and they were also organizing coups, and were infiltrated and collaborating with factions of the Secret Service. They had different motivations for supporting these groups, but this is all well documented. And in the first volume of my book, on the darkest sides of politics, there's a whole chapters devoted to this subject, and there's a huge literature in Italian on it. So this is not anything fantasy. There's been judicial case after judicial investigation after just about these terrorist attacks and about the links between various groups and other groups outside of Italy and so on. So the only reason I mention this is the only time that these neo-fascist groups had any political impact was precisely when they were working together with factions of the Secret Services. Because the Secret Service then gave them cover, they were able to get away with carrying out actions without being arrested and prosecuted and so forth and so on. And so they created a climate of instability, which people within the establishment in various countries tried to exploit in order to reinforce their own power and to keep the communists from winning elections in Italy and so forth and so on. But apart from those exceptions, if you think about the entire history of the West since the end of World War II, there's never been a threat posed by tiny fringe groups of fascists ever. Okay, now let's get to the question of whether there's a security threat. Well, yes, whenever you're dealing with extremist groups, even small, unpopular fringe groups, there's always a security threat in the sense that radicalized individuals or small cells of people can organize violent attacks against their opponents. And certainly when you're talking about the radical right and the revolutionary right, those fringe elements in Western societies, they have the capability of carrying out acts of violence and terrorism. I mean, most of those attacks, and again, I'm excluding the ones that were coordinated and organized in part with the help of the Secret Services, most of the violent attacks that have been carried out by domestic radical rightists have been relatively simple and unsophisticated. You know, like a guy will go into a public place with an automatic weapon and start shooting people or something like that, or they'll assassinate like a designated political enemy, or sometimes they'll try to carry out a bombing or something like that. But generally speaking, we're not talking about sophisticated operations when we're talking about the kinds of attacks carried out by the domestic radical right. Now, there are some exceptions. Of course, we have Timothy McVeigh, who was a military veteran who had knowledge of explosives, who was able to carry out the devastating bombing of in Oklahoma City. We have Anders Breivik, who came up with a very sophisticated, clever way of carrying out a mass casualty attack. So there are exceptions, but by and large, the violent actions carried out by domestic radical rightists tend to be small scale, not particularly sophisticated, and they don't fundamentally threaten the stability of the state.
So why is it that we constantly listen about the far right and to scaremongering about the far right?
Because it's basically mostly propaganda and it's mostly exaggeration. And that's just the reality of it. And in our book, Fighting the Last War, we have a whole chapter where we compare like the relative threats of the domestic radical right and the Islamic radical right, the Islamists. And there's simply no comparison. I mean, the threat, yeah, the security threat posed by Islamists and by especially by Islamists waging military jihad is vastly greater than the threat posed by domestic right-wing extremists, statistically and in every other way. Because we could talk about jihadist attacks. Many of these jihadist attacks, most notably 9/11, but also the March 11th bombings in Madrid, the 7/7 attacks in London, the attacks in Paris. I mean, many of these jihad, especially in, as well as many other parts of the world, many of these attacks carried out by veteran, battle-hardened, operationally sophisticated jihadist groups have been quite elaborate, well-planned, and sophisticated operations. A much higher scale than anything that the domestic radical right has carried
out. Why would people who are supporting the establishment not highlight this danger?
Well, there's a whole series of reasons. First of all, why are they highlighting the danger of the domestic radical right? Because it serves their political interests. It serves their political interests to whip up hysteria and alarmism about the threat supposedly posed by fascists and the far right. Because they use the terms fascism and the far right so indiscriminately, it basically applies to anybody that they don't, any opponents that they don't like, that they're they're trying to create like this fear amongst the population to justify to make it easier for the state to carry out authoritarian acts of repression and censorship against their domestic opponents. So that's why they're exaggerating the threat of the domestic radical right. Why are they minimizing the threat of the Islamic radical right? That's a harder question to answer, but in a way it isn't, because part of it, to be quite frank, is the shocking levels of ignorance that most people in the West have about Islam, about the history of Islam, about core Islamic doctrines, and about Islamism, the ideology of Islamism, and about the currents of Islamism and so forth. You know, the average person in the West, especially including those that work in our security agencies and our intelligence agencies, doesn't know hardly anything about Islam. I mean, that's the reality of it, or Islamism. And one reason is you can sort of explain it from a historical point of view, because remember that the great expansion of the national security state in the United States and in other Western countries occurred during the Cold War. When Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact and Communist China were the main strategic enemies of the West, and therefore most of the people who were recruited into security and intelligence agencies, to the extent that they had academic training, were trained in Russian studies or Chinese studies or those kinds of issues, and that was appropriate. The problem is, after the Cold War ended, you still have all these people who have high-level analytical positions in Western governments, and their areas of expertise are Eastern Europe, Russia, Eurasia, East Asia, maybe Latin America, where there's communist guerrilla movements in Latin America. Very few of them had any expertise about the Middle East or the Islamic world, and that became really painfully evident in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. First of all, the 9/11 attacks should never have happened, because it was obvious to anybody who was paying attention to what the Islamist groups were saying, to what Al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups were saying, that they had been talking about carrying out a major attack on U.S. soil for years. And they had planned several operations, just hijack planes and to blow them up in the midair and all this kind of stuff. They had escalated attacks on American and other Western countries' facilities in various parts of the Islamic world. And they were constantly talking amongst within their own chat sites and in their own statements, ideological statements, their own pronouncements about attacking the great Satan, the U.S. and its allies. And so I taught a class at University of California, Irvine in 1999 and 2000. I taught for the year there, and I was taught courses on terrorism, and one of them was dealing with Islamism. And I was warning everybody, look, these people are going to carry out an attack on American soil. It's just a question of time. And, you know, a lot of people thought that I was being overly alarmist. Well, they can't really, either they didn't really mean it, or they can't really, they don't have the capabilities doing it. And I said, first of all, you have to understand, when you're talking about extremists, ideological extremists are true believers. They're true believers. When they say, when they express views about something, you should always take what they say seriously. Always take what extremists say seriously. And if they're directly threatening to carry out attacks, you better take that seriously. And whether they have the capabilities, well, clearly they ended up having much greater capabilities than anybody anticipated. I mean, the 9/11 operation, the most sophisticated and spectacular terrorist attack in the history of the world. I mean, but the point is that there were a lot of people in the Western intelligence and security agencies who really didn't understand the severity of the threat.
Okay. Question here, because this is something that the audience is going to think about. What you're saying about the expansion of the national security state during the Cold War seems to me to explain the kind of downplaying of the Islamist threat up until 9/11. But it seems to me that post 9/11, or at least not necessarily the immediate years afterwards, but it seems to me that right now there is yet again another effort to downplay, to downsize the threat that you also talk about in the book. So what is it that happened after 9/11? What happened and why do you think that there are people who are carrying on downplaying down the threat of Islamism in the U.S.?
Okay, well, there's a number of reasons for this. And in fact, I talk about it in several chapters of the book, The Darkest Sides of Politics, the second volume. I talk about precisely these issues. First of all, you have to understand that in the West, even after 9/11, there were a lot of people who didn't really understand the real motivations of the Islamists. You know, a lot of people, especially on the left, and even and people in the establishment, said, well, the only reason they attacked us was because of they didn't like our foreign policy. Yeah, and of course they didn't like our foreign policy, but that's not the reason they were attacking us. I mean, all you have to do is read what the Islamists themselves say about what their motivations are, which completely refute these kinds of naive ideas that they were only attacking us because they didn't like our foreign policy. Okay, so there were a lot of people who thought not only that it was response to Western foreign policy, but that we somehow deserved it. You know, somehow we deserved to be attacked because of the ham-fisted way that we've intervened in the affairs of other countries. So even after 9/11, there were a lot of people who were trying to, who were mischaracterizing the motives of the Islamists and trying to almost make it seem like it was the fault of the West that, began. This has to do with the regnant ideas in academia, where there's been a long
anti-Western sentiment.
Yeah, the anti-Western ideas are permeate the entire Western educational system. There was a long march of new leftists through the institutions in the 70s and on, and they basically there's been institutional capture of the educational system in the West, and so a lot of ideas are there's a lot of anti-Western ideas that students are indoctrinated to believe. And a lot of those students, then they, when they graduate or they go to graduate school, then they end up going into other spheres of life. They go into work, they go working for the government, and they still have they've been indoctrinated with these anti-Western beliefs. And so they're also predisposed to kind of believe that somehow the West is responsible. The US and the West are the evil forces that are somehow responsible, you know. And without really understanding the nature of our enemies, even though our extremist enemies make it painfully clear what they believe, you know, day in and day out. Okay, so after 9/11, of course, you did have belated recognition of the Islamist threat, and that then you had like this huge reorganization of the U.S. government, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, which was, by the way, turned out to be a disaster for various other reasons. And there was they really ramped up they wanted to harden the target in the United States, and other governments in the West were trying to harden their countries to make them more difficult targets for the jihadists to attack. And that those were all perfectly legitimate responses. And then, of course, unfortunately, in the U.S., we had the neocons who were running Bush's foreign policy, which caused which led to terrible mistakes like the invasion of Iraq, and also the way that we dealt with the situation in Afghanistan. I mean, we needed to do something to get rid of the Taliban, but we didn't need to have tens of thousands of troops there in boots on the ground and all that stuff. And then going after Saddam, I mean, Saddam was a bad guy. Sure, getting rid of Saddam, you know, you could certainly make a moral justification for it or any kind of justification for it. But the problem is that Saddam and the Ba'ath Party are secular Arab nationalists. They're not Islamists. They have nothing to do with the jihadist threat. And the neocons were trying to conflate the threat posed by Saddam with the jihadist threat by claiming that the Iraqi regime was secretly working with Al-Qaeda and all this kind of nonsense. And then claiming that they had weapons of mass destruction. You know, they were using all these pretexts to justify this invasion of Iraq, which they wanted to carry out anyway. So they wasted all this resources in this bumbling invasion. And then the policies they adopted, de-Ba'athification, which is complete catastrophe, which led, the result of this was that we presided over elections that led to Iranian-backed Islamist parties winning the elections in Iraq. I mean, if you tried to screw the situation up in Iraq, you couldn't have done a better job than you did with the Bush administration. So, but that's a whole nother issue. Anyway, once Bush was out of office, though, and in part as a reaction against the failure of the aggressive neocon foreign policy in the Middle East, Obama comes into office. And Obama, you know, was much more of a progressive and a person with very naive views about the world. You know, if we just were nice to other people, they'd be nice to us. We could all just get along. If we apologize for the bad things we did, and you know, we could reach out to the Muslim Brotherhood. We could do all these things. So once Obama took office, there was a fundamental change in the American policies toward the Middle East and even toward the Islamists. The idea was we could partner with quote unquote nonviolent Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, against the violent Islamists like Al-Qaeda. And I mean, it's just completely delusional beliefs.
Was there a focus so that, for instance, if they killed Osama bin Laden, that was it? It was all just credited to a person rather than to something deeper.
That's exactly right. In other words, the point is that Obama and the people in his administration had no understanding of Islamism at all. In fact, they were both Islam apologists and Islamist apologists. I mean, this is the problem. I mean, many people in academia, in the media, and in the foreign policy, and even in the security establishments in Western countries are not only Islam apologists, but Islamist apologists. And part of the reason why they are Islam apologists and Islamist apologists is because they don't understand core Islamic doctrines. They don't understand the historical development and trajectory of Islam. They don't understand the core aspects of Islamist ideology. And so they're basically living in a fantasy room. They're living in a fantasy room. That's okay. Part of it. So part of it is sheer ignorance about the nature of the enemy. Part of it is political correctness. I mean, there's no other way to characterize it. You know, there's this sort of view that the West is like these evil imperialists and everybody else in the world is like innocent victims of imperialism, and they're oppressed people and the West has oppressed them. And therefore we should have sympathy for the oppressed people. And even if the oppressed people are trying to carry out mass casualty attacks against us. I mean, it's just like this kind of like 12-year-old emotionally overwrought view of the world that so many people in our supposed political elites actually adhere to. I mean, it's just, I don't know what else to say. I mean, I'm shocked at the degree to which so many people in our security and intelligence agencies seem to be utterly clueless about the nature of Islam and the nature of Islamism.
I have a particular example to share with you that I presented a segment on. So there is a appointee of the Biden-Harris administration to the nuclear security wing of the Department of Energy. Her name is Sneha Nair, and she's promoting queer theory.
Queering of the nuclear.
Theory as necessary and essential for improving the U.S.'s national security culture. And she has a document that I read part of it. I had the bad fortune to read a bit of it. And it's, if you read between the lines, it sort of says, if you think that the major threat isn't the far right in the U.S., then essentially you need to be re-educated or removed from office.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the disastrous policies adopted by Obama. And let me just say something. I don't want people to think that, like, you know, that I'm a conservative or a person on the right. I'm not a conservative. I'm actually a classical liberal. I voted for Obama twice. I'm just going to say that. I mean, now I regret it. But the alternatives were so bad that I felt, you know, I generally voted Democratic until recently, and then I changed in 2016. But the point I'm trying to make is that Obama turned out to be a disaster. I mean, not only was he a foreign policy, was he naive in terms of his foreign policy, but he, in his effort to fundamentally transform America, he egregiously politicized the American government agencies. I mean, you know, he appointed various kinds of people with radical ideas to various federal agencies, and those people. And the result is that the federal bureaucracy is now highly partisan, and it's gotten worse and worse. And he also promoted the equity agenda. It wasn't quite called DEI back then, but that was the beginning of all this. I mean, well, beginning goes back to affirmative action, but the point I'm trying to make is this whole diversity, equity, inclusion agenda, that's now the rage in government agencies. I mean, I just read a book by J. Michael Waller called Big Intel or something like that, where he talks about, like, the priorities within the U.S. intelligence agencies now is diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's their priority. Yeah. I mean, you know, not merit. Not actually protecting American security, but, like, you know, promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, I mean, it really shocked me the extent how far the rot has spread here. You know, this is a systematic attack on meritocracy. And anyway, so this is the world we're living in now. We're living in a world, and look at the British government. I think you can make the same argument that you've got a lot of very partisan people in the British state, the bureaucracy of the British state now, who are pushing progressive globalist policies, are promoting, you know, various harmful things, like we can talk about mass migration, open borders, all this kind of stuff. These are people who literally do not understand the nature of the threats that the West is facing.
I'm a bit conscious about time, and I think we should move to the last question.
Okay.
And I will just make a short introduction to it, because to me the answer is a bit obvious, and I'm sure you will think the same. So I come from Greece, and in the 90s, we had some trouble. Our neighbors had some trouble. So there was the breaking down of Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. And the notion of Balkanization comes from there. So that was a sort of, you could say, in a sense, multi-ethnic or multicultural setting that was just unbelievably volatile. It was just, it was a disaster.
Absolutely.
So what does the misunderstanding of Islamism imply for the European multiculturalist project that seems to me to be advocated primarily by a lot of European leaders, not necessarily mm-hmm. by European people. What does that imply for Europe?
Well, so I think it's a disaster. But I think we can actually go back and talk about the whole Balkanization thing. I mean, this is the Balkanization thing goes back centuries. You had the constant invasions and migrations in the Balkan area. And then people would create states and it would incorporate all kinds of different ethnic and cultural groups within the same state. And then the areas were conquered by the Ottoman Turks. And so you just have these polyglot communities and states and the rise of micronationalism and so forth and so on. And by the way, this is something that is common throughout history. Whenever you have large imperial polyglot empires, whenever you have national borders that include very different ethno-cultural groups that don't necessarily get along and may even have a long historical past of hating each other and fighting each other. I mean, you're basically creating unnecessary divisiveness and strife within your own country. So if you have a situation like we have now where Western elites, and only Western elites, by the way, are promoting like mass migration of people from third world countries into the West. I mean, you are essentially repeating the historical mistakes that many other empires have made and many other regimes have made, many other states have made. You're basically creating a situation that where you're going to have increased divisions, internal divisions. You're going to undermine and weaken national sovereignty. This is going to lead to not only political strife, but it's also going to lead to possible violent conflict between different components of your own national community. And look, the real question is why would it make sense for any Western country? The West has created the world's greatest civilization by any objective measure. Freedom, social mobility, technological development, pluralism. On virtually any measure you want to use, the West has created arguably the world's greatest civilization. Why would you want to import vast numbers of people from the world's most backwards, dysfunctional, and corrupt parts of the world? People from cultures that have a tribal mentality, people from cultures that have religious views that are completely incompatible with your own, with Western values. Why would you want to incorporate huge numbers of people from these regressive cultures without vetting them properly and then allowing them to come to your country and to providing them with huge amounts of benefits for free and encouraging them as per multiculturalist ideology, to form their own separate communities, essentially, to idealize their own group, the whole toxic identity. You know, it's promoting toxic identity politics. That's really what multiculturalism is. It's promoting toxic identity politics. It's encouraging other groups to promote their own selfish, narrow ethnocultural interests. Everybody except the majority population. The majority population can't promote its own ethnocultural interests, but every other group in the West is encouraged to separate itself and to promote its own interests. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for social dissolution. It's a recipe for the collapse of social solidarity. And I think, frankly, this is part of the agenda of the elites in Western countries. The part of the agenda of globalist elites is to basically undermine national sovereignty. They want to create a borderless world. They have this bizarre, this fantasy that they're going to create a borderless world and that everybody's going to be like a Benetton commercial. Everybody's just going to get along harmoniously and love one another. And, it's delusional. I mean,
do you see any possibility that this might change in the future?
No, I don't. Here's what I see happening. What we're seeing in the West is a cycle that we've often seen in the past. And that is that the elites who are now in charge of the West have abandoned the values that have made the West great. And they're promoting and institutionalizing policies that are catastrophically harmful, especially to the majority population, the middle class and the working classes of their own countries. And as a result, because they've abandoned the values that have made their civilization great, they're creating all kinds of unnecessary problems and harming their own population. The result is there's growing popular dissatisfaction and growing popular resistance, to the delusions and the fecklessness of their own elites. And as the popular dissatisfaction becomes more acute, then these elites feel more threatened, and then they start behaving in an increasingly authoritarian fashion, using repression and censorship and so forth to try to maintain their power. And so, but as they resort increasingly to authoritarian, undemocratic measures to maintain their power, they lose more and more of their legitimacy. And so it's a downward spiral that ultimately they're not going to be able to escape from. So either we're going to end up with an extremely authoritarian regime run by technocratic elites, which is really seems to be the globalist ideal, or we're going to have total societal collapse, and that may end up in some kind of civil war situation. I mean, I don't see any other real option. I feel like a Roman citizen in the year 450, 26 years before the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. That's the way I feel at the moment. And let me just say one thing about globalists, because the term globalism has been misunderstood and mischaracterized. You know, some people have even claimed if you use this term globalist, it's like secretly anti-Semitic, some, you know, that kind of nonsense. What do I mean by globalist? What I mean by globalist is people who see themselves primarily as citizens of the world rather than citizens of their own country. They see themselves primarily as citizens of the world rather than citizens of their own country. They have more in common with each other than they have with the citizens of their own country. And in fact, they have contempt for the citizens of their own country and the values of the citizens of their own country, who they regard as parochial, ignorant, and uneducated. They're not enlightened. They consider themselves enlightened cosmopolitans and their own citizens to be backward deplorables. And that's basically their attitude toward their own co-nationals. And so consequently, they're promoting various kinds of policies that are destructive, multiculturalism. And multiculturalism is an ideology. Multi-ethnic is a different thing. Multiculturalism is an ideology. It's an anti-Western ideology, where people in the West are supposed to celebrate diversity, celebrate every other culture, whereas everybody else can demonize the West and blame the West for all their problems. So it's a one-sided kind of tolerance. Yeah. Like the West is supposed to tolerate everybody else, but nobody else has to tolerate the West. I mean, that's really what multiculturalism boils down to. So promoting multiculturalism, promoting mass migration from the most regressive regions of the world, which is leading to radical demographic transformation. And then now we have the two-tier justice that we see in Britain and we've seen in the United States for a while, but especially since the Biden administration has taken office, where designated opponents of the regime are subjected to brutal repression, to lawfare, to censorship, to all kinds of authoritarian controls, whereas people that the establishment likes are allowed to run amok and get away with violence and social disruption and so forth and so on. I mean, and where certain people are prosecuted for nonviolent crimes more severely than extremists who carry out violent attacks are prosecuted. I mean, we've really lost the plot here. So this is the world we live in now, and I don't see. There's only one way that the West can save itself, as far as I'm concerned, because we're in a spiral of demographic and cultural collapse. I mean, every institution of the West is under attack by its own elites. The history of the West is being rewritten. The traditions of the West are being attacked and undermined and denigrated in every sphere. So, I mean, how long can a society last when its own elites are denigrating its its core values and its core traditions and its core institutions. I mean, it's not going to last long. And people, its own people. Yeah, exactly. So we're the only way that that this thing can be turned around is for people to vote these globalists out of power. That's the only way in other words, the nationalist and populist parties have to get so much support that when the elections come around, the current regnant elites can be ousted from power democratically. I mean, that's the only way that the situation can change. Look how hard it is. I mean, look at the situation in France with the Rassemblement National. And the party with the largest single number of votes, and yet the entire establishment, joined ranks and prevented them from taking power. They form a cordon sanitaire, to block the ability of anti-establishment movements and parties to come to power.
Yeah, and I think something that a lot of people think is that parties that claim to be anti-establishment are a bit compromised. That's sadly what is in a lot of people's minds. So for instance, I'm thinking of Giorgia Meloni. A lot of people had high hopes for her, and they were let down.
Absolutely.
So would you say that the only way that this could turn around is, for instance, if Trump gets elected and a lot of anti-globalist, in the sense you defined, parties start gaining support from that? That's the only way in which this could be turned around, and
that's exactly what I think. And
civil war could be avoided.
Let me make another very important point. Patriotism and moderate nationalism are not radical right ideologies, even though the left tries to portray them. Patriotism and moderate nationalism are centrist beliefs that the majority of citizens in every nation state have. Their common sense belief, people who love their country and want it to improve. I mean, those are just common sense beliefs that the majority of citizens in every country accept, including every Western democratic country. Yet these kinds of ideas like patriotism and even moderate nationalism are smeared now as being far right and so on and so on. I mean, this is the kind of propagandistic climate that we live in now. And look, let's face it, the mainstream media is nothing more than a propaganda mechanism, a propaganda organ of the progressive globalist establishment, which now includes not only progressives, but the corporate establishment. The corporate establishment is another problem, but the corporate establishment, there used to be two components of the global establishment, the progressive and the corporate. Now they're basically merging together. They're jumbled together. You can't even distinguish between two different elements within the globalist elites that have different agendas, even if they're promoting the same policy for different reasons. Now they're increasingly promoting those policy for the same reasons. So that's what I see. I see that either unless these elites can be voted out of office democratically, which I think is going to be a very difficult thing, I think that we're going to either end up with an increasingly authoritarian technocratic administrative elite, which it rules in an authoritarian censorious way, and to suppress any kind of dissent, or we're going to have social breakdown, and we're going to have like some kind of civil war. And I'd be the last person who would advocate that. I mean, everybody knows that civil wars are tragic events that have catastrophically harmful, and it lead to millions of deaths and disruptions to the lives of even more people. I mean, nobody in their right mind would promote civil wars or this kind of social breakdowns or violent conflict between different components within the national community. No sane person would promote those things because they lead to disaster for everybody. But unless people who are running Western countries wake up and take their heads out of their asses, I mean, I really feel like we're on a downward trajectory, and I don't really see any way to block it. I mean, I wish I could be more optimistic, But one thing that studying history does, it turns you into a bit of a a cynic and a pessimist, because you see human beings making the same mistakes over and over and over again and never learning from their never learning from their mistakes. You know, those who don't learn from history are condemned to repeat their mistakes. I mean, that's, it's an old saw, but there's a certain amount of validity to it. And I just feel like we live in a world where elites live in a fantasy world. The elites live in this little insular bubble where they just talk to each other. And they can not only don't listen to what their constituents say, but they don't want to hear what their constituents say. They have contempt for their own citizens. And I mean, when you have elites that are that out of touch with their own people, I mean, that's a recipe for disaster. No matter what happens, it's nothing good can come of that.
Right. On that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us and for this interview.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
To the audience, I hope you enjoyed it, and see you soon.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.